You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
Welcome to Sustainable Futures. Today's episode will have an interview with Sister Pat Seaman of the Center for Earth Jurisprudence.
I said, whether you're going to be environmental lawyers or not, whatever kind of lawyer you're going to be, it's going to be this relationship with the natural world that is going to impact your decision making. Mm-hmm. At least that's my hope. Right. And that you will carry the concern of future generations and of a healthy earth community into whatever type of law you are practicing in the future.
I'm Ryan Fletcher, and you're listening to Sustainable Futures. So here we are, another episode, another week in the old sustainability racket. And our interview this week is with Sister Pat Seaman from the Center for Earth Jurisprudence. We're going to be discussing the legal system and particularly a class, an elective class, this Christian law school has put together that Sister Pat is running. And we're going to talk about how the defense of the environment connects with the legal systems and get a feel for how the students feel about it here with Sister Pat. So tune in. It's a very good interview. And we're going to have a nice time here on Sustainable Futures. This is Ryan Fletcher of Sustainable Futures with Sister Pat Seaman from the Center for Earth Jurisprudence. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ryan.
And we'll begin with, what is the Center for Earth Jurisprudence?
The Center for Earth Jurisprudence is a center that is established within two law schools in the state of Florida. And our mission is to look at the philosophy and practice of law from an earth-centered perspective. We have our foundation in the writings of many environmental ethicists and also the writings of Thomas Berry, who was recently died in June, but was a cultural historian who furthered his work of cultures to actually the study of Earth itself. And it was Thomas Berry who was the first person, we believe, who coined the term Earth Jurisprudence. And it came from his perspective that what our culture and planet needs today is a new way of doing law and a new way of jurisprudence. From Thomas Berry's work, he does a basic cultural critique of the four major institutions in society. He would name them the educational institution, the economic institution, religion, and also politics or law. Mm-hmm. And he says each of them need to be rethought today in light of the environmental devastation going on, and that their basic premises were founded on a different perspective of a more human-centered world, that all of society and all of reality focused on the human. he would say that in order to go into the future, a viable future, we really need to have an Earth-centered perspective. That's a long lead-in to saying that the Center for Earth Jurisprudence really attempts then to look at law. Primarily, we're looking at it through the lens of U.S. law, but we do work with some international individuals and organizations to really see how does law and governance need to shift so that there is really a sustainable future, not only for humans, but for all of the beings of the planet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and with the term Earth-centered, how would you describe law as it exists?
Well, understandably, I believe our laws today very much come out of a human-centered perspective, and that is we try to develop laws that are going to foster what is best for the human community. Now, I always want to say that it's not even always all humans. Some humans get treated better than others in most of our laws. For example, when we look at our laws in the United States, many of them for public policy start with for the sake of the common good, or that's actually not really used that much today, but for the sake of public good or public interest, we therefore go forth and set up a certain policy. The public interest is always defined as what is best for the human interest, and so it often does not include the interest of the environment that actually sustains life and sustains humans. I believe we're into kind of like an evolutionary process in our thinking that we are more and more aware because of scientific advancements and also from our understandings of being much more connected as a human community that we cannot exist in the future without recognizing the interdependence we have, for example, with available clean water, clean air, soils that can actually produce nutritious food. And unless we look at our laws and the good of the whole, including those entities, we will not have a future for the future generations, or it won't be a future that we really want to hand on to our children because it's going to be very limited.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is this term, jurisprudence?
Yes. I know, it's not a very user-friendly term. Jurisprudence actually comes from the Latin word juris, which means law or governance, and prudence, which is the philosophy of law. So jurisprudence really means choosing from the wisdom of the law. And I know many lawyers who graduate from law school and never actually take a course in jurisprudence, but the term jurisprudence has different meanings, and one of its core meanings is that it should be setting forth the greatest wisdom of law that we have available to us. Now, it can also be used in different ways because each category of law also has, for example, its own practice or its own jurisprudence. So if someone is a land use lawyer or a property lawyer primarily, they would have property law jurisprudence, or there would be criminal law jurisprudence, and that usually means what are the judicial decisions that govern in that area, what's kind of the history of law that has built up. But there is this larger overarching understanding of jurisprudence, which really means the wisdom or the philosophy of law, and that's what we're looking at. We're trying to say what is both the philosophy of law that we need to be incorporating today, and what is also the practice of law in its various fields that we need in order for the humanity to be able to go forward into a healthy future, because the planet is also healthy.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting, the law and trying to make a philosophy or kind of combine legal language and philosophy. Yeah.
Yes, and even when we use the term an earth-centered law, I do want to acknowledge that I don't mean that humans aren't going to be making the laws or the decisions, or that humans aren't a part of that being earth-centered. Well, I know that I personally am not espousing that, for example, that there is no hierarchy of being. But I want to say that Earth jurisprudence flows from that perception that humanity is embedded in the larger environment or the larger Earth community, I would say, all of the beings and all of the entities that make up the natural worlds that we humans live in. And we, over the centuries pretty much, humans have separated ourselves out as though we don't really need to recognize our membership in that larger community. Mm-hmm. And pretty much have learned with all of our technology to think that we can actually manage the natural world for the sake of the human. And I would submit that we haven't done a very good job of it for long term. When we now look at the limits and the constraints that the natural world has. And part of that is because we haven't given any kind of legal consideration to the protection of the rivers and the waterways, for example, of the future. And we have pretty much only looked at protecting what are the human interests in, let's say, the transportation on the waterways or the amount of exploitation of the natural resources we need for our industrial society or in order to keep the global market system going. But we haven't really recognized that there are natural capacities that we have to live and function within. And I would say we humans are a subset of that larger natural world rather than the natural world being a subset of our human world and we get to control it. Very so then if you go with that perspective, then it's like, well, then how does one design policies and laws that are consistent with that, or at least further that inquiry?
Mm-hmm. It's the human and environmental connection. What comes first?
Much of the work that we're doing at the Center of Earth Jurisprudence, we are, you know, we're into law schools and we do conferences and we do courses and we work with practitioners who are actually out there in the field. But I would say also one of the main pieces we try to do is basic education around this shift in consciousness or this shift in awareness. Mm-hmm. If indeed it is a shift. It's not a shift for everyone, but for many of us, it's a shift to actually recognize that the environment and humanity are not separate and that we humans are a part of the natural world. Always have been. It's always been larger than us. Mm-hmm. But because of our ability to think and rationalize and make laws, we have basically put ourselves in a significantly higher priority position.
Now, what actually happens at the center? What kinds of programs is happening? Who goes there?
Well, number one, to say that we are a small staff, and we are into our fourth year of being a Center for Earth Jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. What we have done in that period of time is we've actually created some course curriculum, mm-hmm. new courses and seminars that are offered, that have been approved and offered at St. Thomas University Law School in Miami and Barry University Law School in Orlando, that offer courses to students. They're all electives, of course. Well, anyone going to law school takes the traditional and required courses and then have certain electives. But we like to think that we have value added to our courses, and that one of the reasons we wanted to do this is we believe that the future attorneys are going to be living in a continuing complex world, and that the questions of environmental security, of environmental devastation on the other side of that, those questions are going to touch the practice of law regardless of what kind of law you're going to be working in. So whether you're working in securities and corporations or whether you're working in property and or land use laws, even perhaps if you're doing criminal law, because there is certain jurisdictions internationally that is looking at, for example, the question of biocide. I mean, the total devastation of biodiversity. Well, will we come to a point where it's intentional, conscious elimination of species? Will that be perhaps a certain criminal activity of biocide or that we may look at in the future? We primarily find that the students that are most interested in what we do are students interested in concern about the environment, not necessarily going to be environmental lawyers, but often by the time they finish up our courses, they have a deeper appreciation for how environmental laws and how the natural world actually impacts the future, even those that are very much concerned about working with family and children law and those that are working in healthcare law. The connections are becoming obvious that health and the future of children is very much tied to the quality of life that the natural world is able to provide as well. So we teach classes and seminars. We offer different conferences and workshops. We've done two major symposiums, which, and some of those findings can be found on our website, which I will just say now is www.earthjuris.org. But we have gathered international people to look at this question of earth jurisprudence and what is its future, what is its implications in international law. We have done workshops on local education on climate change, on water issues. We have several workshops pending. One will be looking at future generations. Another is looking at our own Florida Everglades, our own ecosystem where actually both schools are located in. So we also have been doing some publications. We have a quarterly newsletter called Groundswell, and that can also be found on our website. And we have just done our first, what we call an occasional monograph, that is looking at an interdisciplinary approach of law. It will be looking at interdisciplinary approach of law, science, and theology. And our first publication is called The Intrinsic Value of Nature, looking at law from both a legal perspective and from a theological perspective to see where are the underpinnings in ethics and in law that actually looks towards an intrinsic value of nature, mm-hmm. as well as its instrumental value. And in our society, we are normally used to an instrumental or a use value of nature. And we want to propose, not that others haven't also, but we want to advance the idea that the natural world also has an intrinsic value in and of itself. It's not only here, only for human use, but it has its own fulfillment and its own purpose, and it serves other beings besides humans as well. So those are some of the projects that we've been engaged in over the last couple of years.
Does the environment have a legal identity?
Interesting. I would say, I think perhaps aspects of the environment have gained some legal protections, such as in the U.S., the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, mm-hmm. so that if certain parties are shown to pollute beyond a certain acceptable limit that the law has named, then there are some legal remedies that usually the state or the federal departments of environmental protection can come in and litigate. The litigation and the protection is really for the sake of human health. It's very seldom that it's actually for the health of the water or the air itself. Mm-hmm. So in order to get standing in our courts today in the U.S., we have to show that we, the person who's filing the petition, has actually been injured in some way. Mm-hmm. And so there are a number of cases where organizations or individuals have filed suit for the protection of a park or a certain animal, but they have had to show that they themselves are being injured, and usually they have to show that they're being injured from some kind of aesthetic reason. Perhaps it's a health issue.
Rather than the park being injured or the park being harmed.
But the actual air or the park or the wolf, for example, whatever is the animal, or the salmon, it's not because they're being injured. It's because there are bilateral effects on a human.
Right, okay.
So one of the things that we would like to see considered in the future is that more of the natural world is actually given a standing in and of itself so that it can gain some legal consideration and have some redress, and that the public in and of itself could perhaps bring these lawsuits. I'd like to propose that we think not only lawsuits, but because that's always an end result and often not a very good win-win situation, but are there ways that we can create policy that actually considers the interests of these various entities, whether it's a piece of land or a watershed or a wetlands, and consider their viability and their integrity as a part of the policy? Certainly, I'm aware that with environmental legislation today in this country, almost any kind of development project or a project that's going to affect the integrity of a watershed, that's, for example, has to file an environmental impact statement. But that environmental impact statement is to be considered. It doesn't have a legal protection in and of itself. I mean, that certainly is a step forward. I wouldn't want it not to have the environmental impact statement, but it is the impact statement, again, comes back to show in the end how is the human affected,
right,
and in the proposed activity.
So the Center for Earth Jurisprudence, does it have a Catholic persuasion? How does the Catholic tradition fit in? Because I understand that
that's a very good question.
Yeah.
I would like to say yes and more than that. Let me just back up and say why the Center for Earth Jurisprudence is actually in the schools that it's in.
Okay.
As it started. There was a woman benefactor, her name was Marie Gendron, who gave money to further Catholic education in the state of Florida. And I, at that time, wrote a proposal that looked at this sense of earth jurisprudence, because I was beginning to work with this. And there, at that time, there were two Catholic law schools in the state of Florida, so I thought, what a wonderful way to actually be able to further a sense, in a big sense, of what Catholic means, meaning care for the common good and care for the natural world and the sacredness of the natural world, and could we actually set up a center that holds core values of having a sense of reverence for the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, we received the grant, and that became the seed funding for the center. Now, obviously, if you're a law school in this country, you are fully ABA accredited, and you're not really, I would say that the religious perspective is infused in some of the courses, but you're getting your degree as a lawyer, not as a Catholic lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So what I want to say is that, yes, what we try to do is consistent with Catholic teaching in its best understanding of the natural world and creation, having a certain capacity to reveal the divine, and that it has an ability to have people experience a deeper experience of themselves in relationship to the natural world.
Okay.
However, I find that those values are very cross-cultural and not applied only to those of the Catholic faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to say that the Center for Earth Jurisprudence, while we carry those values, one doesn't have to subscribe to that in order to participate with us.
Mm-hmm.
What we are looking for are partners and practitioners who really care about the future of the Earth community and of the environment and humans within it. And anyone who wants to come of that goodwill and cares about future generations, cares about their children, cares about how we actually treat or how we recognize the limits of the natural world and live within those limits, those are many of the people that we work with.
Okay, you answered my next question. So people with kind of, if I could give it a blanket, maybe spiritual persuasions?
Yes, I would say that, yes, that basically we're coming out of a certain spiritual perspective.
Yeah.
And even with that, one does not have to subscribe to a spiritual perspective. However, I think to have a deep care and concern about what's going to happen to future generations of our children and future generations of other species. So for many people, just the devastation that is going on is motivation enough. For many people, taking a very rational approach to law and to the path that we are on, subscribe out of their own basic sense of integrity and what needs to be done for the common good. And it doesn't necessarily have to be motivated out of a spiritual perspective. Mm-hmm. For me and for how we founded the center, it does very clearly take on a spiritual value, I would say, of reverence.
Mm-hmm.
That calls me into accountability on how I live my life and how much energy I use and where I, how large is my carbon footprint and all of those kinds of questions. But that is not meant to be a barrier to anyone else who really wants to further the sense of care for the environment.
Mm-hmm.
You are listening to Sustainable Futures on CJSF 90.1 FM. This is an interview with Sister Pat Seaman of the Center for Earth Jurisprudence.
However, I do very much like the idea of reverence for the environment. I think that's a very
pure place to come from. Yes, and what I find is that I just came back about 2 weeks ago from an international conference of people who were gathered on Earth Jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. And we came from, well, there are 26 of us, and we came from 14 different countries. And so much of what we talked about had to do around a basic reverence for the natural world. Now, many of the people there, I would say probably at least 10 or 12 out of our group, either are people from indigenous cultures or are working with people, with indigenous peoples who are working to protect their own tribal and traditional lands.
Mm-hmm.
Truly, I think the people who have the greatest sense of what Earth Jurisprudence is, and they've never used that language, are people who have come from many of the traditional indigenous practices, because they, at least traditionally, are much more aligned with their own existence and the existence of the natural world as being one. And they often, what I kept hearing at this meeting is that the law is in the land, that the land actually teaches us kind of the right behaviors that we need to have, mm-hmm. not only with each other, but in the sense of balance and harmony and reciprocity back.
Mm-hmm.
So I live and work in a very Western world and in law school settings, and we are not embedded in indigenous cultures.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the main gifts that they bring is that sense of reverence, the sense that Earth is alive in many ways and has an existence in and of herself. And that can come very close to some of the spiritual practices where we learn that we really need to listen to the voice of Earth, listen to the water, listen to whether it's the birds or the trees or the ocean. What are they saying to us today about their survival and flourishing into the future? And with the mounting climate change and the very real, already existent and mounting sense of like acidification of the oceans, that the oceans now are also absorbing so much carbon dioxide that we're beginning to see the die-off of some of the very life forms in the ocean that we haven't even been aware of that are there.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the oceans are becoming acidified in a similar way to where our air is, you know, our atmosphere is reaching its capacity of how much poisonous and greenhouse gases we can put into it. So I believe that the natural world also, through some of its, I would say, suffering and loss, is also speaking quite clearly if we but have the ears to hear and the eyes to see.
Yeah.
So it does take a certain kind of compassion and a certain kind of reverence to move into the future in ways that, at least today, we think will do no harm.
One thing that's just popping into my mind just now is our disconnect because of the urban environments that we're in. And it can be difficult for many people to get a true appreciation of the natural world because what they're surrounded by is human structures where we've taken what exists and made something different that doesn't look like the materials that are part of its structure. It looks like something different.
Right.
Right.
Yes, I think that is very much our reality. Such high percentages of our global population live in very dense urban areas, and many of those people do not have opportunities to go embed themselves or take some days off to go, you know, to a national park or whatever, mm-hmm. or go to the ocean or whatever it is that may feed one's soul.
Mm-hmm.
I think what is so important is that we try to support people living in those areas with recognizing that raising their families in as healthy an environment as they can and trying to show ways that one can even garden on one's patio or porch or even to pay attention. I think a lot of it has to do with how do we pay attention then to whatever parts of the natural world are present to us.
Uh-huh.
And I think of the resilience of certain plants and blades of grass that will force their way through concrete.
Concrete, yes.
Now,
that's one of my favorite
though,
images. I love that.
Yeah. You know, we get pretty upset with those persistent, quote, weeds that keep coming up and cracking the concrete, but maybe there are some lessons in it.
Yeah.
The persistence of life to not be cemented over. And also that people in dense urban areas do find areas of beauty, and I think that's what's so important, that there be some mm-hmm. kind of community initiatives that would claim some small area in their neighborhood where there can be beauty,
mm-hmm.
where there can be trees, where there can be plants, where there can be a garden, ideally. But if that's not possible, then I think it's a whole other area to say, how do we support people and not have them feel guilty
mm-hmm.
if they can't get away to a larger area of natural beauty? But how do we support the areas of natural beauty for themselves? And one example, very little, it doesn't really address this issue, but it has some, for some reason it comes to me now, but like when I teach my seminars with the law students, I require them to do like a one-page journal reflection back to me each week. It's not on the readings and on the writings unless they want to. Instead, I ask them, they have to spend a minimum of 10 minutes each week in some kind of intentional presence to the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
And they can spend longer, but I said it can be with your child when you go for a walk. It can be with your companion animal as you play with it. It can be with a plant that you have in your home, or maybe you've got a patio with some garden, a tomato plant growing or something. Ideally, you get an opportunity to even immerse yourself more, but where do you see beauty of the natural world in your daily or weekly environment? And what I find is that the student's ability to pay attention grows in the course of the semester. And I invite them to start out by using their senses. What do you see? What do you smell? What do you hear? What do you touch that puts you in contact with some aspect of the environment or the natural world? It begins to create, or there at least is an invitation there for them to consider their own inner being in relationship to the natural world. And the reason I tell them I want them to do that is because I said, whether you're going to be environmental lawyers or not, whatever kind of lawyer you're going to be, it's going to be this relationship with the natural world that is going to impact your decision making.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. At least that's my hope.
Right.
And that you will carry the concern of future generations and of a healthy Earth community into whatever type of law you are practicing in the future. And what, bottom line, what I really love about it is it helps me develop a personal relationship with the students and to start to see how they process and what's important to them.
Okay.
But it is a way of connecting them in some small way to the natural world.
What kinds of classes? Are these small classes where students can get really engaged? What sort of classroom environment
yes.
is this?
The answer is yes, because they're electives, and they're mostly seminars, and for at least in our two law schools, seminars will run from 10 to 15, although my first couple of seminars in what I call the Principles of Earth Jurisprudence, we actually had 18, 19 students the first couple of times that we ran it. So it's lovely because it is a seminar. There's not a test in this kind of educational process. They have to submit either a project or a written paper.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a time to really engage in dialogue, do the readings, explore together. And as I tell them, you know, they are a part of actually building this consciousness and movement of Earth jurisprudence. So they're on the front end of trying to help bring the critique and the questions. Probably the greatest critique I get with this is that it's not practical enough. And then the other part, because it has a strong philosophical bent. And then the other piece of it is, well, you know, how do I get a job with this?
Right.
I really love it, but how do I support myself?
Yeah.
And
which is a valid and common question, probably.
It's a very viable question, and that's where we are working more and more to see where we can place students in internships and work-related opportunities that may evolve into a paid position. And then, but I don't say it's never going to, but I suppose it's safe to say it's never really going to be a job in Earth jurisprudence. It's going to be a position where one carries this consciousness and ability to relate. And those who are actually practicing environmental law, and many environmental lawyers, they don't use this language but are already doing this in many ways, the way they frame questions, the way they try to frame solutions and consideration of the natural world. But that is probably the most practical place. Now, one of the things that's quite promising for students today is that because of the mounting ecological devastation going on and with climate change, there are more and more businesses, state and local governments, federal governments that are looking at how do we green society? How do we move towards a truly ecologically sustainable society? There are more possibilities for students to be able to get positions and make contributions in this whole area of ecological sustainability than obviously there was a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to say to the audience, I want to make a distinction of green. Green often has dollar signs on both sides of the word. And a lot of the times when you come across a company that says green, it's not a really deep philosophy that they have. It's more of another way to make money.
I concur.
Yeah.
And I also struggle with the word sustainability even, and always try to the degree I can to place, when I'm using it, ecological sustainability in front of it, because that word has also been hijacked in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I want to put this into context for people that are more of an activist kind of person. How important do you think law is in affecting societal change?
Well, I think it's important because it is the vehicle that legitimizes a lot of the behaviors that are going on currently. Do I think law is the beginning of societal change? Absolutely not. I think that before law can ever change, there has to be an intense participation of the public to name its future and what it wants,
mm-hmm.
whether it's around the concept of transportation, truly alternative renewable energies, clean water. The public will and the public participation, to me, is the first step of bringing about laws that are going to hopefully support change. Even before the public participation, I think there has to be a huge shift in consciousness as to why all of this is important. Mm-hmm. But I would say that I feel that the major lack that we have in our society today to move into the kind of future we need is basically the political will to make it happen. And then there are certainly some very moneyed interests that are a part of disassembling that political will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you can have a law and you can legally make a decision, but without the will to actually make it happen, then it's...
Exactly, and we've seen that in various administrations over the years. So just having the law on the books is not sufficient if it's not also going to be enforced and implemented. At the same time, I do believe it's very important to have laws that support certain behaviors that we want, because the challenges we face, I do not believe, can be addressed just only individually. It is going to take state and nation, federal action, and international action to actually address some of the major challenges. At the same time, I'm a firm believer that some of the most effective changes happen locally and regionally, and that the kinds of solutions we need for an ecologically sustainable future has to come from the ground up,
mm-hmm.
and then almost like be ratified at a national or federal level.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very interesting. It seems
that's how nature works pretty much.
Yeah.
And one of the things about Earth jurisprudence is we do try to look at the laws of nature and how nature organizes herself and sustains herself, and has pretty much, except for the last maybe 100 years of our intense industrialized society, has sustained itself flourishing. And so, I'm talking about the last 65 billion years since we came back into this era, but nature has an incredible ability to refurbish itself and re-nurture itself and regenerate. So how do we do that as human communities?
Mm-hmm.
That's all part of what I think is the transition town movement that is becoming more viable across this country and internationally. And that all is focused on the local communities,
mm-hmm.
figuring out their future and delighting in designing a future that would be viable at the time of the end of peak oil or great energy restraint.
Mm-hmm. I can see, in this conversation, we have some real connections happening where it seems like it's from the inside out. It seems that the Center for Earth Jurisprudence seems to be of that philosophy as well. Would I be correct in saying that?
I would say yes. But with the hiatus, that people do approach this differently. So I would say that definitely is my vision and understanding, okay. that it's from the inside out. But it also requires a collective action and not only individual transformation.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that, and I do believe that the sense of Earth jurisprudence and how nature governs herself, that it's based on a relationship primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a relationship of not being separate, seeing ourselves as separate from. And then I would say what you said, yes, inside out. Although I would say I may have colleagues on our team that would perhaps see it slightly different.
Mm-hmm. And maybe the truth is that there's got to be a combination of the both. Because
yes.
you have to be enabled to do
certain
things as well.
And I would want to say that however one comes to this is okay.
Yeah.
And it's welcomed. There will be no litmus test.
I want to see if we can get a feel for how do the students feel about this. If I were studying law and going to law classes all day, I would be very excited to go to a class like one of these. How do the students react?
I think the students that participate in the seminars, that is true.
Yeah.
And they are probably our best advocates. However, I have no illusions. We are a very small program. And law students, at least at both of our schools that I work with, some of them are full-time law students. They're working. They have families. And so the amount of time they have to give to what some think is somewhat of a peripheral or philosophical perspective and isn't going to get them a job when they get done. I understand that. So I want to say that for the students that I truly feel like the students that have participated in the courses, that they really have become very alive and energized, and they energize others. It is definitely, though, a minority who will clear out their schedules to take a course such as ours.
Right.
But I think for many students, it's the pressure, obviously, of having to get a job and and find a place in a legal career that they find some of the teachings of Earth jurisprudence philosophically very nice, but doesn't get them a paycheck.
Right, yeah. And I guess like going to something like law school is a big investment or a gamble with your career, because these things are not inexpensive. They're pretty expensive.
Exactly.
So I guess there is that certain pressure to get a job and get going.
And pay off the student loans is huge.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So that's, you know, not only a challenge to the lawyers, that's what we're talking about here, but I mean, that's part of the way our whole society is structured. To have true education and to be able to really appreciate it, we are so driven in our culture and in our market economy, and in order to survive, to actually pay the bills. But I do believe that our educational system has turned into a model of basically providing people to match jobs and careers and very little kind of actual critical thinking and critical preparation to really provide a sound philosophy for life. It's very much focused on the here and now and short-term practical job skills.
The way it seems to work, I mean, we're at a university here at Simon Fraser University, and the system of education now, and perhaps for quite a long time in its history, seems to be setting people up for desperation because of the financial gap that they get in order to pay for all this education, that in the end it actually becomes kind of limiting, and that you need something so fast you don't have much time to look around and explore your career, your thoughts, your ambitions, your dreams. It's almost a system where you make your choice and you pay your money and you hope you get in.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's on the front end. And then when you finish up, you've got this career. And then if you find out that it's really not a really good alignment, most people have to stay with it for a number of years with the hope that they're going to earn enough money to actually do that which they love.
Yeah.
Which is probably that which they love is probably their truest vocation and the best sense of what they are meant to, you know, to do with their gifts. Yeah. But people, so many, many people do get trapped in it. And then, as you said, it can become a life of desperation.
Mm-hmm. But then I think people do what they love, and it's just outside of class. I think we all, in our own way, are doing what we love in some way. In smaller levels, it's a matter of tuning into that, maybe.
Yes, that's very good. Yes, I do believe that. I think people find, eventually, if the pain increases enough, they will find a way to find that which they love, yes. I hope so.
Well, I must say, I love talking with spiritual people, doing spiritual kind of interviews.
Thank you. Thank you, Ryan.
Is there anything else you wanted to say in this interview?
Well, what I wanted to say, I think, is that I do believe that the human heart hungers for meaning. And to me, when we find that meaning, that is a part of the whole spiritual path. And I am so aware, though, that for some people, at least, even using the language of spirituality, people choose to disconnect because I think it connotes for many people certain conformities or controls, and so people don't want to have any part of that. Right, but I find in my own life that the essence of a spiritual path that's in alignment with my own inner meaning and value and a true belief. See, I truly believe that whoever or whatever was the mystery that started this whole evolutionary process of bringing forth the cosmos and the natural world is actually has embedded terrific creativity within the natural world and with us. And it's only when we get in alignment with that creativity that we really probably reach the best of ourselves, which I call our spiritual self.
Mm-hmm.
And
I like what you said about the connotations of spirituality, because in fact, I've done it myself in this interview. I wanted to establish where Catholic meets spiritual so that, because it can be a stopping point and someone will say, well, I'm not Catholic or it's not broad enough for what I believe, even if they are Catholic, right? Because of the older systems or the way the history of these religions have gone, the difference between dogmatism and openness.
So I would want to say that Earth jurisprudence is not tied to any specific religious tradition or spiritual path. We happen to be embedded within two Catholic universities that has given me terrific freedom to go forth and to truly try to attend to what we see, the human responsibility to care for the natural world and to see ourselves as one in it, and probably premised on the core belief that the natural world is also a reflection of the divine.
Mm-hmm.
And so that any time parts of the natural world, including the human, gets degraded or somehow despoiled, it's also at its heart that mars the reflection of the beauty that we all hold. And I think, I don't know if I want to use, anyway, in that the whoever is the mystery of the creator also holds.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for spending time with Sustainable Futures.
Well, you're welcome, Ryan, and so it's been a pleasure.
So this is Being Ryan Fletcher with Sister Pat Seaman of the Center for Earth Jurisprudence on Sustainable Futures. Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainable Futures. I hope you enjoyed our interview. I hope you got something from it. This legal system of ours is certainly an interesting thing. I just want you to know, if you'd like a copy of this episode or any other episode of Sustainable Futures, you can download those for free off the website www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net. All you need to do is put Sustainable Futures in the search bar and all of the previous episodes will come out. This is episode number 44. And I wish you a very good week, and I also wish you good health and a sustainable future.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.